Hello, I'm Lauren Shatner. This is number 0262, the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. And it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0262. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, you'll meet Nick Yaris, who spent 21 years on death row for a crime he didn't commit. He's the author of 7 Days to Live.
It was a very convoluted series of events that began with my arrest originally in the city of Chester, Pennsylvania in December of 1981 by a police officer who had charged me with attempted murder. From there, everything spiraled out of control when I landed in prison, went through drug withdrawals, made up a stupid story about a murder I had nothing to do with, and then when the police found out I was lying, they put a prisoner in a cell next to me so that he could say I confessed to him.
Terrence D. Shulman, founder and director of the Shulman Center for Compulsive Theft, Spending and Hoarding, talks about shoplifting.
I used to be a shoplifting addict. From age 15 to 25, a few years after my parents' divorce, I became the man of the house. I had a lot of issues. I wasn't dealing with a lot of stresses. I began to shoplift, both to save money, but also, you know, emotionally, I felt so overwhelmed, and I felt like life was so unfair and burdensome that it had kind of a symbolic quality. When I would take any kind of object, it made me feel like I was tipping the scales of fairness back in balance. And I got hooked and truly lived a secret life. Nobody knew I was shoplifting for a 10-year period from age 15 to 25.
Stuart Nullman is back with another edition of Book Banter.
Hi, I'm Stuart Nullman. And on Book Banter, Stephen King dabbles in the police murder mystery with Mr. Mercedes. So get ready to be chilled on the Stuff File program.
And of course, there's lots and lots and lots of Stuff File news and an idiot of the day. The guest Slater, the person who told you this was show number 0262, was Lauren Shatner, a children's entertainer and also a grade school friend of mine. And you can check out his website at loonylorny.com. That's LOONYLORNY.com. And of course, you'll find the link to loonylorny.com on the What's On page for this week's Stuff File program at thestufffile.com. And thank you very much, Lauren, for doing the guest slate on this edition of the Stuff File program, a program that's also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Let's get right to the stuff, shall we? Okay, maybe this is the only thing worse than finding out someone's broken into your home. Finding out someone's broken into your home and is still there and is naked in your bed. Yikes. But that's what police say happened in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Police say a couple returned home to find 30-year-old Freddie Shelby naked and asleep in their bed. And he didn't wake up until police ripped the blankets off of him. He reportedly told police he thought he was at his girlfriend's house, which doesn't really explain why he allegedly came in through the window, or on the other hand, maybe it does. Anyway, he's been charged with breaking and entering. This sounds like the makings of a bad Goldilocks porn parody, doesn't it? Yeah. Our good friend Bob Welsh at WDEV in Vermont brought this one to our attention. Thank you very much, Bob, for bringing this one to us. A West Virginia interstate highway was closed for almost 7 hours Friday morning when an SUV overturned and spilled its bizarre cargo of 35 to 40 chickens, a dog, a jar of marijuana, an AK-47 rifle, a large load of ammunition, and altered fireworks that police initially thought might have been bombs. Unfortunately, the dog died. Sorry to say that. The chickens ran around for a while, and the driver was thrown in jail. The SUV, a 1998 Ford Explorer with Pennsylvania license plates, flipped shortly before 3:30 a.m. on Interstate 79. Rowan County Sheriff said that the driver said the dog tried to jump out of the vehicle, causing him to lose control. When emergency crews arrived, in addition to the chickens, they found the rifle, the ammo, the marijuana, and suspicious devices that led them to call the state police bomb squad. 21-year-old Seth Grimm, yes, that's his name, Grimm, was treated for minor injuries and was being held on $25,000 bail on a charge of possession of a controlled substance with intent to deliver. Yeah. You know, stories are always funnier when you can add the term "and a chicken" to them. But when there are 35 to 40 chickens, well, that's just a plain laugh riot. Anyway, two age 30-ish men, somewhere in that vicinity, knocked on the door of a Sebastian, Texas woman at 12:30 a.m. on August the 3rd, asking for water and if they could please come in to charge their cell phone. And the woman apparently cheerfully invited them in, later offering them the use of her own backyard shed to grab some sleep. She did not learn until a short time later, when a law enforcement manhunt widened into her neighborhood, that they were wanted for murdering a U.S. Border Patrol agent. Officers arrested the pair inside the shed. Now, this is a woman who has a guardian angel on her shoulder, because clearly she is too daft to develop safety standards and common sense on her own. And we go from a woman who is too trusting to a few stories dealing with people who clearly have anger management issues. Number one, a 40-year-old man's throat was fatally slashed in August in Laurel, Montana, in a fight with an acquaintance over which military service, Army or Marines, is better. At press time, we still haven't been able to determine which branch of the military was the winning side in that argument. Story number two, a 37-year-old man survived, but with multiple bullet wounds in New York City, in a 1 a.m. dispute during the making of a rap music video. The dispute was over who exactly would be the star. Yeah. And number three, Roger Harris, age 63, and Brian Bandez, age 42, brawled on the seventh tee at the Springdale Golf Course in Uniontown, Pennsylvania, while arguing the rule of playing a ball that is in a rain puddle. Harris apparently three-wooded Bandez in the head. Bandez landed punches, causing a swollen jaw, a fat lip, and a scratched eye. Note that all three of these stories dealing with anger management seem to take place in what are normally casual, warm settings. I hope none of these people have stressful jobs. That could be dicey. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, in Multnomah County, Oregon, in July, a Romanian princess, you don't hear that very often, do you? Romanian princess? A Romanian princess pleaded guilty to cockfighting. You don't hear that often either, by the way. 61-year-old Irina Walker was born in Switzerland, where her father, King Michael I, lived after abdicating the throne. She came to Oregon in 1983, where in a second marriage in 2007, she fell in with former deputy sheriff John Walker, who had moved on to gambling and cockfighting businesses, according to a USA Today report, and she was assisting him. So that's why she was arrested and thus pleaded guilty. Now, wait a second. how do you go from being a deputy sheriff to going into the gambling and cockfighting business? That's what I'd like to know. And by the way, doesn't Irina's entire life sound like a bizarre TV soap opera? Yeah. Anyway, let's get to our first guest, shall we? Nick Yaris was framed for murder and lost 21 years of his life in prison for a crime he did not commit. He spent 8,057 days on death row until he was exonerated in 2004 thanks to DNA testing that showed he couldn't have committed the crime that he was serving time for. Nick tells his story in his new book, 7 Days to Live, and he joins us on the line from California. Hi, Nick.
Hi, how you doing, Peter? And thank you to everyone listening.
Thanks for being on the program with us. I'm doing well. First of all, let's go back to the crime you were framed for, the murder that you had committed. Who framed you? Do you know?
Yeah, I was framed by another prisoner who had committed a burglary on the prosecutor's home, who was handling the case. It was a very convoluted series of events that began with my arrest originally in the city of Chester, Pennsylvania, in December of 1981 by a police officer who had agreed that, who had charged me with attempted murder. from there, everything spiraled out of control. When I landed in prison, went through drug withdrawals, made up a stupid story about a murder I had nothing to do with. And then when the police found out I was lying, they put a prisoner in a cell next to me so that he could say I confessed to him.
Wow. So you actually confessed to a murder that you had no knowledge of?
No, I never did. That's the thing. That's the shame of it. There was never anyone who said I claimed I did it. What the prisoner claimed was that I was worried about my family, who was my alibi, being caught lying for me, because the police couldn't understand how I had a concrete alibi with three of my family members, a shop owner and a bank teller, all saying that I was in Philadelphia, 26 miles away from the crime scene, a half hour before and a half hour after the crime.
Okay.
So there was no possible way that I could have committed the crime, but they had to undermine it. And what befell me was that I was acquitted of all my original charges of that police officer in Chester, Pennsylvania. And when that happened, the prosecutor took it as a personal slight. So I ended up getting a 3-day capital murder trial out of anger for everybody thinking that I was a nut job. The murder was of a woman working at a mall who was abducted after her shift in Delaware and driven into Pennsylvania in December of 1981. And it was a real mystery. So they just made up a motive saying that I did it because I was disenfranchised with my girlfriend and I was a nut job. So I was treated in the utmost severest ways you can imagine.
And how old were you at the time?
I was 20.
Okay. You mentioned your family. As you say, they told a story that you couldn't have possibly committed the crime. And the reason why I bring up the family is because you spent 21 years in prison. After you
23 in total, yeah.
Yeah, after you spend that much time in jail, at some point, the members of the family who couldn't exonerate you, who believed in you because they knew where you were when the crime took place, but other family members, other friends, at some point, do they lose faith in thinking, well, gosh, he's here all this time. Maybe he's guilty.
Yeah, I had some members in my family that weren't there at the dinner party that night. My sister hated me because I ruined her marriage. My conviction ruined her in the social standings. So she hated me as a way to deal with it. And when I was released, she couldn't stop hating me. She said, Nick, I can't just turn this off. So I'm sorry. I'm not just going to hug you and everything's okay. I understand that you're not guilty, but this has just hurt me so much that I've hated you for so long. I can't stop hating you.
Well, with your 21-year incarceration and the fact that, like you say, your sister can't turn it off like a light switch, during that time period, do you become bitter?
You go through it all. You begin bitter. I was in my first 2 years on death row in Pennsylvania, unable to speak in my cell, even sitting in my cell, because of the way that the regime worked. And they tortured us, and they did horrible things to me, and a lot of the other prisoners took advantage of me early on because I couldn't defend myself with eloquence and speaking. I had no acumen. I had no education. I was illiterate, and I was dysfunctional, and they all made folly of me. So I worked very hard to overcome a lot of torturous early beginnings. When I was so angry, I used to beat my head on a wall. It was the only way I told myself I could get out of there if I just kept hurting myself and stayed alive. Look, you have to understand, I was in Huntington Prison in Pennsylvania, and the average lifespan for a prisoner was only 5 years. I miraculously lived through 12 years of that torture.
Your problems didn't begin, though, with this murder conviction. Your problems go back to when you were 7 years old. Tell us what happened then.
Yeah, a total destruction of my early upbringing began at the age of 7 in 1968 when I was assaulted by a man in my neighborhood who beat my head in with a rock, and he left me with a dysfunction in my brain called aphasia. And aphasia is simple enough identifiable when someone stutters, but mine was full on. It was just so bad that in times of stress I would just shut down and I couldn't process language. And I just became an early alcoholic and drug addict to deal with the frustrations and fears because I tortured myself like a lot of young boys do when you're attacked. You wonder what it is about me to make another male do that to me, and why did he have to do that to me particularly? And so it drove me crazy, and I ruined my childhood. And it's because of the drugs that I used that I ended up getting arrested and being off the rails as I was.
And you were not only beaten when you were 7 years old, you were sexually assaulted, were you not?
Yes, sir. That's the worst part of it, because like I said, what tortures a young boy who keeps it secret is you ask yourself again and again, what would make another boy attack me in a sexual manner? Why would he seek me out in that way? And, you know, was it me? Was I gay? All these things, and it just tortured me for so long. I didn't tell my parents until I was 24 years old. After I escaped from death row in 1985 and I turned myself back in, I finally told my father and mother what happened to me as a boy and how it wasn't their fault. And I was making a clean break when I did that. That was the hardest decision I made, even worse than asking to be executed for something I didn't do.
You just touched on something that I wanted to bring up, and the fact is that you escaped from death row at the age of 24. How does someone escape from death row?
A series of mad events led to my escape in Fraser, Pennsylvania, when I was being transported to court. And after 25 days, I just couldn't take it. I kept seeing the images of what they were going to do to my family and my brother, and I really, for the life of me, just could not do that. And there's no such thing as escape. You just run away for a short term. So I did the only thing that made sense, and I went back. They put me on Florida's death row next to Ted Bundy for 8 months before putting 35 years on my sentence and sending me back to Pennsylvania to be executed.
Now, the title of your book is 7 Days to Live. And first of all, I think it's miraculous, the idea that you, as you talked about, you were at the time when you were younger, you weren't educated, you were functionally illiterate, you were on death row, to now you have written a book, you are married, you have a child, things have turned around. Let's talk about the book. Why the title 7 Days to Live?
It was something that my spiritual advisor said to me. Oh, and by the way, I'm so grateful for the opportunity to let people, they can find me. I moved back to the United States. They can find me on nickjyarris.net. And one of the things that really struck me was when I was asking to be executed because I was ill in prison and I was dying, and I figured I wanted to go out with grace. And so my spiritual advisor at the time asked me, why on earth had I stopped? Had I stopped living each day as if I had 7 days to live? Because when she met me, even though I had misery in my life, I still lived every day as if that's all I had. So I wanted that to be the turning title, because I learned a great deal more about being alive than just living and breathing. And it goes so much more to who we care about. And I really appreciate that opportunity I've been given to write the book, and I have a film coming out in January. So I'm very grateful for these opportunities for my art to be taken seriously. And the way I did it is, it's not a self-glorification in any manner. I've done the writing so that I can imagine myself sharing this story with the audience facing with me and then telling them about the people I met and how important they became in my struggle to find myself and to keep hold of myself once set free.
Your film, as you say, is coming out in January. The movie is called 7 Days to Live.
No, it's not. It's not actually under a different title, but they want to leave it as a mystery for now, so good with them. I'll leave that for now, but I'm really excited about the book and the opportunity for this book tour that's coming up. I have appearances coming up on the Today Show as well, and I'm really excited for that. The book has gotten very good reviews, and everyone who's taken the time to read it has really been enlightened by the efforts I've made as a writer, not just as a former prisoner or someone who's gone through this.
And we should also mention that that portions of the proceeds of your book will support the Cordoza School of Law's Innocent Project, correct?
Yes. Great friends of mine, Barry Sheck and Peter Neufeld, have stepped in and helped me revive all of my efforts. And it's to them and that they helped so many people get set free from this madness. I mean, 86 people alone this year have been set free from wrongfully incarcerations, and 111 last year. It's astounding the numbers of people who they are helped by these organizations. So if I can help them back, then even though they didn't get a chance to help me, because like I said, I was pushed to the point where I had to ask to be executed. So it was one of these things where I also want no one to ever sit there feeling that there's never going to be help coming.
As I said, you've turned your life around completely. You found love. You got married. You had a daughter. How old's your daughter now?
She's 8.
Eight.
I just got married in Las Vegas in January 16th of this year to my wife, Jessica, and we're now living in Los Angeles, where we're developing a major motion picture for my first book, 7 Days to Live. So I have a really good opportunity in the United States to start over. And I lived the last 9 years in the United Kingdom, where it was a great honor that I got the chance to speak before governments, high bodies of controlling EU bodies and everything. So it was really nice that I went all over and spoke for so long.
Well, you know, you're talking to us in Canada. You lived in the UK. I've just got about a minute. Those two countries, Canada and the UK, do not have the death penalty. The United States still does. How do you feel about the death penalty, especially after spending over 8,000 days on death row?
The first thing I did when I left death row, one of the first things I did was I drove to the Trevose River up in Montreal, and I went to the Richelieu River. And for 5 minutes, I stayed in Canada just with the nice feeling of not having the death penalty. So that's how much I felt about that, sir.
Okay. People can find out more information about your book and you. They can check out the book, which is 7 Days to Live. The website is nickjyaris.net. Nick, I thank you very, very much for taking the time to be on the program with us. It was a pleasure to talk to you.
No, I'm so grateful for the opportunity, Peter. Thank you to your staff and everyone, and I wish you all the best, sir.
Nick Yaris, author of 7 Days to Live. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0262, and you'll find links to Nick's website, plus links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly.
You're listening to The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. You can email him at peter@thestufffile.com or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Kelly Alexander Show is your place to be for everything to do with health, lifestyle, and entertainment. Join us as we chat with celebrities like Emmy winner Mia Michaels from So You Think You Can Dance, best-selling recording artist Taylor Dane, and world-renowned astronaut Julie Payette. We also cover important topics like breast cancer awareness and how to help your child through bullying. All this and more, please join us, www.kellyalexandershow.com.
It's the Kelly Alexander Show.
Capture your need for sound.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Have you ever noticed on some of those public broadcasting pledge drives, they tend to sound like ransom demands in a kidnapping?
Hey, your kids like this, Mr. Rogers. It would be most unfortune if, for some unforeseen reason, you weren't in the neighborhood no more.
Well, I'm here to ask for your support in a non-threatening, non-obligatory kind of way. Part of the success of The Stuff File depends on the generosity of its listeners worldwide. So if you can, and if you want, please feel free to make a small one-time donation. Just go to the website at thestufffile.com and click on the PayPal donation button. You can donate $10, $5, or even $1, whatever you'd like.
You know that big bird? That would be one huge drumstick. If you know what I mean.
If you have a PayPal account, it's an easy transfer. And if you don't, all major credit cards are accepted. Your generosity would be much appreciated in keeping this show running.
About that antique roadshow, they might be seeing a little more concrete than they originally anticipated.
No strong-arm tactics, no ransom demands. Just a simple please and thank you. To donate, visit thestufffile.com.
From the land that brought you maple syrup, poutine, ice hockey, and Pamela Anderson, this is The Stuff File with Peter Anthony Holder.
And still to come on the program, we will talk about shoplifting, plus Stuart Nolman is along with another edition of Book Banter, and we do indeed have an idiot of the day, plus lots more Stuff File news here on a program also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. We got a couple of stories here that you can consider them least criminal, or least competent criminals, rather, or not ready for prime time. Two of them. So let's put them together here. Number one, a 40-year-old unnamed man was arrested in Seattle on July 31st after a several-hour, epically inept crime spree. Attempting to rob a restaurant, he was turned down by employees and customers, then turned down by two potential carjack victims, the first of whom added insult to injury by pulling out her cell phone camera and shooting video. This was all before he just decided to give up, and that was when, by the way, police arrived. His only take was the $15 he had swiped from the restaurant's tip jar. And number two, 27-year-old Joshua Pollock entered a total of four businesses in Woodbridge, New Jersey on July 27th, and similarly met resistance and or indifference to his money demands, and came away from the four with only $2, also from the tip jar. Yeah, well, Two things we've learned here. At least for these two guys, crime doesn't pay. That's one. And also, you should really lock down your tip jars. Yeah. Meanwhile, a South Carolina woman was arrested for allegedly beating a man in his 60s after the man drunkenly passed gas in her face. Witnesses told police that 33-year-old Jessica Cerny was asleep on her couch in her Myrtle Beach residence when 64-year-old Daryl McKnight entered the home and let one rip in her face. According to police, Cerny walked outside to get away from an intoxicated McKnight, but McKnight walked out also. The two were arguing over the incident, and McKnight walked towards Cerny, cursing in a threatening manner. Cerny stated that she pulled her arms down, and when McKnight bent down, she struck him in the face approximately three times with a closed fist. McKnight had to be taken to a hospital for treatment of a swollen right eye, while Cerny, unless she develops a case of delayed pink eye, suffered no injuries whatsoever. Both parties were issued citations for fighting, and this is my favorite line of the story. It is unclear if they knew each other prior to the incident. Really? I mean, so what? Total strangers are walking into people's homes and passing gas in their faces while they're asleep on the couch? If that's the case, I think they better get, you know, more door locks in South Carolina. Yeah. We got a couple of stories here under the headline of ironies. It can only be classified as sheer ironies. Number one, an airborne banner being towed by an airplane came loose in Fremont, California in July and floated down, landing on a house, frightening the residents. The sign advertised Geico Insurance. Yes. And number two, a 10-foot-tall pine tree in Los Angeles's Griffith Park, dedicated in 2004 with a plaque to the late musician George Harrison, was recently destroyed by an infestation, and another will be planted in its place, according to a city councilman. The infestation? You want to know what was the infestation? The cause of the infestation? Beetles. Yeah, well, there's nothing really that I can add to that, is there? Kind of speaks for itself, doesn't it? So we'll just move right along. A Croatian man known as the Penis Collector, yeah, you heard right, has been arrested for allegedly abusing his position as a hospital nurse to amass a large collection of human organs taken from the bodies of dead patients. The unnamed 52-year-old man, who worked as a registered nurse at a city hospital in Slavonski Brod, was arrested last week on charges of disturbing the deceased. Oh, it's disturbing on so many levels. But anyway, in his apartment, police found glass jars filled with penises, or should that be peni, preserved in formaldehyde, presumably in pickle jars. Said a hospital spokesperson, on behalf of all employees of the hospital, I have to say that we are very unpleasantly surprised by an event that threw a shadow over this hospital. Our apologies to families of the deceased. According to reports, the suspect is a family man with no previous criminal record. Yeah, like, that really makes a difference at this point, huh? It's not clear what led police to the man and his morbid collection. But if I were to hazard a guess, it might be all of the corpses sans penis that show up after his shift. That would be my guess. I'm just putting that out there. Anyway, we have time for one more Stuff File news story before we get to our next guest on the program. It wasn't unusual for a 27-year-old man and three children ages 3 to 6 to show up at a Happy's Pizza in Muskegon Township, Michigan. But according to the police report, the man was wearing only a towel and carrying a gun. Even though the restaurant was open, the man couldn't get the door open and apparently got angry about not being able to get in and started banging on the door, discharging his .40-caliber pistol and smashing the glass. He left and walked home, where police found him on the porch. An officer ordered him to drop the gun, and when he did, they took him into custody and called Child Protective Services. The unnamed man allegedly admitted to taking four hits of acid before heading out to eat. Okay, so what I need to know is, was he wearing the towel before he took the four hits of acid? Or was that the result of his, you know, trip? Yeah. Good parenting skills. Good parenting skills. Anyway, let's get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, shall we? Terrence D. Shulman is the founder and director of the Shulman Center for Compulsive Theft, Spending, and Hoarding. He counsels clients in person, by phone, and via Skype from across the U.S. and the world. And he has authored four recovery books, including Biting the Hand That Feeds, The Employee Theft Epidemic. And Terrence joins us on the line from Detroit. Hi, Terrence.
Hey, Peter. Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Thanks for being on the program with us. You created this center, so I'm assuming you felt there was a need for this. And the very back end of your book says epidemic. So how and when did this become an epidemic?
Okay, so we've got a few epidemics, actually, so let's zero in. I think our topic for the day is why women steal, the underground secret of the American housewife. But shoplifting behavior is an epidemic. At least the U.S. stats report that about 90% of Americans have shoplifted at least once in their life, and about 10%, or roughly 30 million Americans, are shoplifting with some degree of regularity. Employee theft behavior is even more prevalent, both here in the U.S. and probably worldwide, with up to 75% of all U.S. employees engaging in some dishonest behavior, and most doing so repeatedly. And then I also work with overshopping and overspending, which I think people have heard of, and hoarding disorder, which has been in the news for the last decade or so because of the cable TV shows. But I got interested in this because I used to be a shoplifting addict. I'm 49. I'm in Detroit. But from age 15 to 25, a few years after my parents' divorce, I became the man of the house. I had a lot of issues. I wasn't dealing with a lot of stresses. I began to shoplift both to save money, but also, you know, emotionally I felt so overwhelmed, and I felt like life was so unfair and burdensome that it had kind of a symbolic quality. When I would take any kind of object, it made me feel like I was tipping the scales of fairness back in balance. And I got hooked and truly lived a secret life. Nobody knew I was shoplifting for a 10-year period from age 15 to 25, was arrested two times, and then finally spilled the beans and got help about age 25 in the middle of law school in 1990. And since I went back to school and became a therapist after being a lawyer for a few years, and I found out that there are so many people, men and women alike, who steal for various reasons which we wouldn't think. It's not always about economic need or greed.
Okay, so what are some of the other reasons?
Yes, and when I say this, I know it's controversial. I in no way mean to make excuses, and I do believe there should be accountability. If you break the law, you break the law, and there's going to be accountable. Like, you can be an alcoholic, and everybody knows you've got the disease of alcoholism, but if you're drinking and driving and you're caught, there's going to be some consequences. But the real thing is the consequence just throwing somebody in jail or also maybe looking at treatment options. So there's a number of reasons, particularly why women, I find, shoplift. And if you think about all the different kinds of behaviors that people can do based on family of origin traumas and losses, so some people, you know, have been sexually abused, who I've worked with, and, you know, some people may turn to drugs, alcohol, or food, or gambling. Others, people turn to shopping or stealing or hoarding. So there's a lot of core issues that go on in people's lives, like I said, unresolved deaths, traumas, divorces, abuses, neglect, you know, even taking on, like, the role of the hero in the family and having to be the caretaker for everybody. I deal with a lot of people. And then in a way, over time, all that giving of one's time, energy, and even money at times to other people, you get a little bit, you know, kind of you're cranky about it at a certain point. And taking or stealing can kind of suddenly develop as a counterbalance to all the overgiving. But I also, for a lot of people who maybe don't start early in their life with stealing, but after a dramatic change or loss in the middle of their life, or a lot of times I'm working with women who are not satisfied in their marriage and they're longing for something more, but they're not getting it, so they might start over-shopping, and then the over-shopping might lead to arguments about spending money, you know, with their husband, and then they figure out maybe if I shoplift a few things, it won't end up on the credit card bill, and before you know it, it can be a full-fledged addiction.
Wow. Now, is part of the problem that we as a society kind of accept it, and I bring that up because I've never shoplifted. Okay.
Oh, you're in the minority, Peter.
Well, that's the point. When I tell people that, the response usually is, "Oh, come on, you never took a chocolate bar when you were a kid?" And the answer is no. And they look at me like I'm the weird one, and I'm thinking, does everyone do this?
Well, I don't know that everybody shoplifts. In the Canadian and global statistics, I don't know how similar they are to the U.S., but if the question were more broad, Peter, and I don't know if you're willing to confess here, but, you know, if the question is, have you ever done anything dishonest, like have you ever taken from the workplace? Have you ever taken something from an individual? Have you ever cheated on an exam? Have you ever lied on your taxes? Have you ever used somebody's credit card without permission? You know, I mean, I think probably we would agree there's very few people who would, you know, be 100% honest in life. That's not to make an excuse, because just because a lot of people are doing something does not make it right. But my goal has been not to make excuses for people, but to help people who are getting arrested and arrested, you know, time after time, promise they won't, you know, do it again, tell their family they won't do it again, and yet they don't get to the bottom of it or even recognize that stealing behavior can be addictive. And the kinds of people I work with, generally speaking, whether in person here in Detroit, by phone or via Skype, are well-educated people, middle to upper middle class people. I've even worked with some multimillionaires, and so everybody around them is scratching their heads, including my own clients, who I ask them, why are you stealing? And they say, I don't know. I've got the money. I had thousands of dollars in cash or on credit cards. I don't know. And they can't see the forest for the trees because they're that sick. And I help peel back the onion layers to give them a roadmap of what might be going on. And then, even when we figure out perhaps what is going on, if they've been stealing for years or decades, it becomes a habituated pattern, and we have to develop kind of an ongoing recovery program, because they can develop a strong urge or temptation and have a relapse before they know it. So I enjoy my work because people are very ashamed of their behavior. Most intuitively know this is wrong, and I work with religious people who say, I know, thou shalt not steal. But until they meet other people and talk openly, and I'm a recovering person, I have support groups locally, by phone, and online. I have books that people can relate to. I try to incorporate the family or the spouse to help everybody say, no, your partner's not a plain thief. They're not crazy, but there is something going on, and we need to treat it seriously.
Okay, you counsel people all over the United States and indeed the world, but you do, as you mentioned, live in the Detroit area. That is a part of the United States that is having tough economic times. Do economic times make this worse?
Yes, they do. And again, that's not an excuse, but we have seen over the last several years, there's been a few kind of minor studies that have shown that with the recession that began, at least here and sometimes globally, even it's thought, around 2007, 2008, there's been an uptick, according to stores, in both shoplifting and employee theft. Interestingly, the converse is true. When the times are booming, people also kind of, because there's more people out there working and there's more people out there buying in the stores, so there's also an uptick when the times are good or really good. So it's kind of maybe counterintuitive. But a lot of people also, you know, during the holidays is another period of time where, as you probably maybe have heard, that not only over-shopping increases, but shoplifting and employee theft. So we're not too far away from the Thanksgiving, Christmas, holiday season, you know, for both U.S. and Canada. And that's going to be another time where a lot of people are really going to have bad holidays because they're going to get in trouble and not start the new year well.
Okay, so if there's somebody listening to this right now, has this situation, has this problem in their life, knows someone with this problem in their life, they're hearing what you have to say, how can they get in contact with you and what can you do for them? How can you be of help to them?
Sure. Well, thank you, Peter. So first of all, you know, I offer free consultations, brief consultations by phone, by email, via Skype. People can go to any number of my websites, probably for our purpose, and all my websites are interconnected. I've got several of them. The easiest website to remember would be kleptomaniacsanonymous.org, O-R-G. And that'll link you to all the different websites. My main website, theshulmancenter.com, and I've got one for shopping addiction, employee theft, and for shoplifting and for hoarding. And they can call me or email me. My phone number is right there, 248-358-8508, and my email address, TerrenceShulman@theShulmanCenter.com. They can call me, they can email me, they can try to Skype me, and we could talk about what's going on either with that person individually or somebody that they know or love. They might be just interested in reading some of my books on the topic, which they can order from me directly through PayPal, Amazon. We have all four of our books on both regular book format and ebook format. There is a listing on our website of support groups. There are a lot of articles that people can read on the various topics or disorders that I treat. There are video archive clips. I've had a lot of media exposure over the last decade and a half talking about these issues, which are still unfortunately underground because not only are they epidemic, but the reality is unfortunately there's not a lot of treatment options for stealing behavior, overshopping, or hoarding. We're just kind of getting into that. So very few support groups, very few books, very few therapists, but there are some.
Okay, we have less than a minute, and this might be a tough question to answer in that period of time, but you've talked about shoplifting and employee theft. Are those really two different types of people or the similar type of person?
Very good question, Peter. What I found, and quite frankly, I mean, I mentioned earlier how I used to shoplift. I did engage in some employee theft behavior, too, back in my early days between age 15 and 25. Most of what I find in my clients, most come to me for a shoplifting problem. Secondly, for an employee theft problem. But a good portion of both have done both behaviors. But there definitely are people. Shoplifting is when you're not working for a store, but you're taking from a store. And employee theft is when you're working from a store and taking from a store, or you're working for a company and you're doing time theft, lying on your time card, taking long breaks. That can be considered a fireable offense. Taking office supplies, intellectual property, obviously money, funds, things like that. So that's a more widespread problem, believe it or not, but there are people who overlap, and there are people who say, I only shoplift, I don't steal from work, and others who say, I only steal from work, I've never shoplifted.
Interesting topic indeed, and people can find out more information. They can go to your website. You mentioned several. I'll mention your main website, the Shulman Center, Shulman, S-H-U-L-M-A-N, Center, C-E-N-T-E-R, theshulmancenter.com. Terrence, thank you very much for being on the program with us.
Peter, thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Terrence D. Shulman, the founder and director of the Shulman Center for Compulsive Theft, Spending, and Hoarding, and the author of Biting the Hand That Feeds, The Employee Theft Epidemic. Now, you can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0262, and you'll find the links to Terrence's website, plus links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
I'm Bob DiRico-Jones, and this is Let's Be Fair. People who have heard about our wacky warning label contest often ask if there are certain kinds of labels that we don't accept for our contest, even if they are funny. That's a great question, and the answer is yes. There are many hilarious warnings that aren't necessarily common sense, so they're needed for consumer safety reasons. I'd like to tell you about one funny label that we haven't used, and why. The warning comes on packaging for a pain reliever called PMS Mitol. Obviously, it's for women, but it warns, do not use if you have an enlarged prostate. Now, let's be fair. You don't need to be a doctor to know that someone with PMS is not going to have a prostate. Kids, trust me. But the side effects of this medicine on a man's prostate are not common knowledge, and there may be a man out there with a headache so bad he's willing to use PMS Mitol. So that warning needs to be there. If you have a funny, common-sense warning that would be good for our contest, send it to us. Find out how at centerforamerica.org.
If you or someone you care about is struggling with food and body image issues, don't ignore the signs. Eating disorders are serious, potentially life-threatening illnesses, but recovery is possible, and you don't have to suffer alone. Call the National Eating Disorders Association helpline at 800-931-2237 or visit nationaleatingdisorders.org to take a confidential online eating disorder screening. Recovery is possible.
From our studios in Montreal, Canada, and going out to the rest of the world, this is the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. It's time to crack a spine. The Stuff File presents Book Banter with Stuart Nauman. Once again, here's Peter Anthony Holder.
And we're going to get very scary, very scary. Stuart is here again. Hello, Stu.
Gee, thanks, Count Floyd. Yeah, that's a nice little build-up. But yeah, on this edition of Book Banter, we're going to talk about something scary. Stephen King. But you know, he's besides being a master horror writer, he's quite the literary chameleon. He's written books on different genres, and no genre is too scary for him, that's for sure.
Yes.
Yeah, it's true. Now, reading Stephen King's latest novel, its first foray into the police detective mystery slash thriller genre, which is called Mr. Mercedes, one thought crossed my mind. Fellow mega best-selling author James Patterson now has some major competition in this genre. Now, the novel centers around Bill Hodges. He's a retired police detective for a major American Midwestern city who was haunted to the brink of suicide by one of his last, albeit unsolved, cases. It seemed that a crazed lone driver stole a Mercedes-Benz car and proceeded to plow through a crowd of people waiting outside for a job fair to open its doors. It killed 8 people and injured 15, and the killer got away. So while with the case of the Mr. Mercedes killings left cold, Hodges spends most of his retirement time sitting in front of the TV and playing with his father's .38 caliber pistol. Don't you know you shouldn't be playing with guns, Mr. Hodges? However, that changes when the owner of the stolen Mercedes, her name is Olivia Trelawney, commits suicide over the guilt being associated with the killings. And Mr. Mercedes sends taunting messages to Hodges via Debbie's Blue Umbrella, sort of a Craigslist type of social media website. Now, this prompts Hodges to become a renegade, independent lawman, and personally reopen the case, albeit without the sanction of the local police department that he previously worked for. Now, to make matters interesting, while he investigates the crime further, Hodges falls in love with Olivia's sister, Janie, and gets entangled with the dysfunctional dealings of Olivia and Janie's surviving relatives. Now, however, a tragic event further reinforces Hodges' determination to solve this case, especially when Mr. Mercedes himself, who's known as Brady Hartfield, a mama's boy of the most extreme nature, who works as a clerk at a home electronics store and is an ice cream truck driver. He's plotting this next fiendish mass murder, which is scheduled to take place at a boy band rock concert in the city's largest concert venue.
I'm sorry, did you say ice cream truck driver?
That's right.
Okay.
Oh, like the ding-ling-ling-ling-ling.
Yeah, okay.
That kind of ice cream truck driver.
I gotcha.
You know, like the good humor type. Now, with Mr. Mercedes, King has succeeded where James Patterson has done so many times before, crafted a riveting race-against-time battle of wits kind of thriller between a flawed cop and a deranged homicidal maniac.
Who drives an ice cream truck?
Yes. Well,
I still can't get past that. Anyway, only Stephen King. Only Stephen King.
True. I mean, yeah, I guess even homicidal maniacs have to have a soft side to them while serving soft serve ice cream, I guess.
I guess so.
And King has got the formula down pat, and the result is a thriller that you really don't want to put down, even while you're having your ice cream, so that you can see if Hodges is able to foil Mr. Mercedes' murderous plot before it's too late. And King adds his trademark horror writing to the angle of Brady Hartsfield's sordid life and world, a world surrounded by hate, anger, extreme computer savvy, bloodlust, and the Oedipal complex. It's a chilling, insightful portrayal of the circumstances of what turns a human being into a mass murderer, and the subplot of the tragic circumstances of his late brother Frankie and how it contributes to Brady's dark way of life is practically heartbreaking to read. And Mr. Mercedes, I have to admit, proves that Stephen King can feel comfortable writing in another literary genre and produce an entertaining book that will keep you just as glued as one of his horror epics. Now, if James Patterson can branch out and start writing novels about telekinetic teenagers and haunted hotels, I tell you.
Yeah, I've often said that we live in a world that is way too politically correct. Mm-hmm. And there's a fear of being creative anymore in this day and age. And I've often said that if someone like a Stephen King came along and started writing the kind of things he wrote early in his career and probably in school before he first started getting published, what would happen is he would get a psych evaluation and be heavily medicated.
Yeah, and spend some time in a psychiatric ward.
And we'd never know the literary genius of Stephen King because they would deem him a threat to society.
Yes. A very big threat. I mean, they've done that, you know, in the 17th and the 18th centuries.
Well, they're doing it now. They're doing it now. There are kids who are being yanked out of school because of a composition they wrote.
Yeah, it's just very very sensitive. The world is becoming really, really sensitive.
It's sad.
I mean, I can't blame them, you know, with school shootings, with the rash of school shootings going on. But maybe sometimes they just get a little carried away.
Yeah. Anyway, we're getting off topic here. The current book is?
It's called Mr. Mercedes by Stephen King. It's published by Scribner, and it's $36. And this book has been doing very well.
And
surprise.
I'm almost afraid to ask what other types of books do you recommend in this genre because the field is so wide.
Yes, it is. It's very hard to narrow it down, but I managed to do so. A couple of books. Thomas Harris, who wrote the original novel Silence of the Lambs. I'm not recommending that one. I'm recommending the first Hannibal Lecter book, Red Dragon, which is, I think, even darker than Silence of the Lambs and the sequel Hannibal.
Another person that would have been locked up in school.
Oh, yeah. He probably would have been if he didn't have a chance to publish Red Dragon. He also wrote Black Sunday, too, which was an action thriller. But Red Dragon, excellent book. And also on a nonfiction level or scale, I recommend probably one of the best true crime books that ever came out, Helter Skelter by Vincent Bugliosi about the Manson murders. and which gives a really in-depth look at, you know, at the case, at the murders, and at the at Manson and his family, you know, himself. And it's just, you know, this reads like a crime novel, but unfortunately it wasn't. Right. But an excellent book. I think it just set the standard for how true crime books should be written, actually. Okay.
And again, this current Stephen King book is?
Mr. Mercedes, by the man himself, Stephen King, the literary chameleon, published by Scribner, and it's $36.
And how can people find Mr. Nullman?
Well, if you want to find me, you don't have to look at any psychiatric institute, that's for sure. You can find me in the Montreal Times every week, in print, available every Saturday, or online at www.mtltimes.ca.
And that's because you're feeling much better now.
That's right. It's amazing what antipsychotic drugs can do.
Stuart Nullman with another edition of Book Banter here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
The Stuff File.
And we're just about at a racetrack for this edition of the Stuff File program. We have a few more Stuff File news stories and, of course, an idiot of the day. Here on a program that's also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Have I mentioned that already? Yeah. You know, you can discover new shows, favorite shows, over 20,000 different shows, entertainment and sports shows, by downloading the app for Stitcher Smart Radio. It's the smarter way to listen to radio, and you can hear all the shows you want to hear, including the Stuff File program, on your mobile device. Wouldn't that be grand? Yeah, absolutely. Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Okay, Troy Winters, the pastor at the Open Door Baptist Church in Dry Ridge, Kentucky, is offering a $250 reward for the identity of two teens who, he says, have broken into the church four times in the past months. They don't steal anything. Instead, he says, they taunt the church's surveillance cameras, cook pizzas, and destroy property. Okay, so my question is, how do you break into an open-door church? It's always open. Maybe you should get, I don't know, locks? Anyway, Shannon Kepler, age 54, is a police officer in Tulsa, Oklahoma. His wife, Gina, age 48, is also a Tulsa police officer. They were hired on the same day 24 years ago. Ah, isn't that romantic? Yeah. Shannon apparently disapproved of his 18-year-old daughter's choice of boyfriends. Their daughter, Lisa, says she and her boyfriend, Jeremy Lake, age 19, were in front of her boyfriend's house when her father drove up. When her boyfriend stepped forward to introduce himself to him, Lisa says her father pulled a gun and shot him several times. Lisa says she dove for cover when he turned the gun on her. Shannon also allegedly shot at Lake's 13-year-old brother, grazing his arm. And then he just simply drove away. Just drove away. Shannon turned himself in and has been charged with first-degree murder and shooting with intent to kill. Gina was charged as an accessory to murder for allegedly hiding her husband from detectives. Lisa says she had just moved in with Lake because her father threw her out of the house for, wait for it, making poor life decisions. Wow. Okay, you know, she's what? She's 18, she's young, she's inexperienced, this is the time of life when you make poor life decisions. That could be explained. So what's her father's excuse? I mean, seriously, what's her father's excuse? I was tempted to make him the idiot of the day, but no, this story was too tragic for that. But fear not, boys and girls, because right now we do indeed have the idiot of the day.
And now it's time for the strange things adults do. The Stuff File presents the idiot of the day.
A 24-year-old woman who loves giraffes was kicked in the face after she entered the giraffe enclosure at the Henry Villis Zoo in Madison, Wisconsin. Amanda Hall climbed into the exhibit so she could get up close and personal with a 2-year-old giraffe named Wally. The 12-foot-tall animal first licked Hall, and then he booted her in the face. Hall sustained non-life-threatening injuries, and Wally was not harmed. Hall was cited for harassment of zoo animals, an offense that carries a fine of $686. Things could have been much worse for Hall, because giraffes are capable of delivering blows that can kill lions. Yeah, so The question has to be asked. Although, really, it doesn't, but I will anyway. So why? Why? Why would someone break into a giraffe enclosure at a zoo to be at one with the long-necked creatures? Well, one reason, and one reason only. She's an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program number 0262. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0262. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as P.A. Holder, and don't forget to check out the Stuff File store, where you can purchase a plethora of Stuff File merchandise, from t-shirts to mugs to tote bags to mouse pads. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, streaming on PCJ Media and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded on iTunes and Stitcher, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. Bye-bye.
Been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. Any rebroadcast of this copywritten program in whole or in part without the express written consent of... Oh, God, who the hell are we kidding? Who's going to steal this show? God, who writes this stuff? Holder, what a kidder.